The really interesting thing about hashtag activism in particular is that it becomes this kind of shorthand organizing principle for people who have experiences that don't normally get covered in mainstream media or by mainstream press to come together and share those experiences. And the collection of those experiences does two interesting things. So first, it validates them, right? So if you've experienced something and I've experienced the same thing, if we can connect those experiences, then suddenly our experiences sort of collectively feel more real. And when people can collect these things together, they become newsworthy in themselves. So we see over time the mainstream press maybe not covering individual incidents, but covering the hashtag and the collection of those incidents as a newsworthy event.
Welcome to this episode of Untangling the Web, a podcast of the Web Science Trust. I am Noshir Contractor, and I will be your host today. On this podcast, we bring in thought leaders to explore how the web is shaping society and how society, in turn, is shaping the web. Our guest today is Brooke Foucault-Wells. You just heard her talk about hashtag activism, the title of an award-winning book she recently co-authored. Brooke is a professor of communication studies and a core faculty member of the Network Science Institute at Northeastern University. She's also the director of the Communication, Media, and Marginalization Lab at Northeastern. That's COM for short. She studies how online communication networks enable and constrain behavior, with particular emphasis on how these networks both enhance and mitigate marginalization. And in 2019, she was a general co-chair for the 11th International ACM Conference on Web Science. Welcome to the podcast, Brooke.
Thanks, Nash. It's great to be here.
First, Brooke, I want to start by congratulating you on the publication of your book, Hashtag Activism, Networks of Race and Gender Justice, which you co-authored with Sarah Jackson and Moya Bailey, and was published by MIT Press earlier this year. I also want to congratulate you on being recognized by the International Communication Association with a 2020 Applied Public Policy Research Award that was associated with the publication of this book. I want to start with the title of the book, Hashtag Activism. What does that mean to you?
Thanks, Na. So it's an honor, obviously, to both publish the book and receive an award for our work. And hashtag activism was a term that was coined by the press to kind of malign this form of activism that emerged around the so-called Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, where folks use the internet as a way of organizing and proliferating messages of resistance and solidarity with marginalized communities. We kind of co-opted or hijacked that term to really interrogate the role that the web can play in advancing progressive social justice movements. And our argument in the book and more broadly in our body of work on hashtag activism is that hashtag activism is a logical and sensible extension of the use of media by resistance movements and social justice activists, dating back to the historical Black press and the civil rights movement and everything in between. Hashtags in particular have become associated with social justice movements in a way that's meaningful and powerful and affecting social change.
And you've talked about in your research about several specific hashtags that you have looked at over the years, things like Girls Like Us, Ferguson, My NYPD. What did you find when you were looking at these specific hashtags?
Yeah, so the really interesting thing about hashtag activism in particular is that it becomes this kind of shorthand organizing principle for people who have experiences that don't normally get covered in mainstream media or by mainstream press to come together and share those experiences. And the collection of those experiences does two interesting things. So first, it validates them, right? So if you've experienced something, I've experienced the same thing, if we can connect those experiences, then suddenly our experiences sort of collectively feel more real. And when people can collect these things together, they become newsworthy in themselves. So we see over time, the mainstream press maybe not covering individual incidents, but covering the hashtag and the collection of those incidents as a newsworthy event. And as you know, in communication, mainstream media coverage is still the gold standard for setting an agenda and creating policy change.
And from a point of view of web science, What insights have we gained by looking at the role that hashtag activism is playing in changing society and transforming the public discourse?
That's a great question. So one of the things that's really striking about web science as a set of tools, and also just sort of logic of thinking about the world, is that these conversations have always been happening, but they're happening in private and in a way that was really hard to track, especially at scale. And now we can, not only can activists and people, regular people, find each other online, but we as researchers can find those spaces and reflect on them more fully and completely. Obviously, we don't have access to everything that's happening, but we have access to so much more, and so much more of the kind of routine, everyday organizing efforts that are going on. Web science gives us the tools and the access to study that and understand how it works.
Indeed, your book covers this topic quite extensively, but it ends in about 2017. A lot of people call the summer of 2020 a global reckoning on social justice. Given everything that we have seen recently, what new insights or what generalizations do you think about and reflect upon in light of these social justice movements?
You know, so one thing people will often ask when they ask about this book is why these particular events, or why did this happen in the way that it did? And of course, we don't have the counterfactual world where Ferguson didn't happen, or the Me Too movement didn't happen, or some other thing didn't happen. But one of the things that I think gets lost when we talk about hashtag activism is that there are, of course, these sort of spectacular events. So high profile murders that get a lot of attention, where people rally around, and there's massive spikes in certain hashtags. But these networks that get built, so the web is sort of inherently networked, and these networks persist, right? So these conversations are still going on. It may be quiet ways. So it's not as if people stopped talking about Black Lives in 2017 and didn't talk about it again. In fact, they've been talking about it the whole time, and these networks kind of laid dormant. They weren't covered in the media. And then another horrific incident happens. Lots of people are paying attention. And we suddenly see not only the activation of the folks who are talking about these things in 2017 and 2018, but this whole new swath of folks who are suddenly in tune with what oppression and marginalization looks like, because they're seeing it and they're experiencing it in their everyday lives. So I think part of the reason we have this sort of massive surge of attention and this sustained both online and offline protest is that the networks are there, and the networks are building and feeding each other and sustaining each other to keep this movement going.
You raised two really interesting points. One is that these networks, if you may, go through periods of dormancy or latency and not much in the public eye, but they're all there, and then they occasionally will surge in visibility. And the second thing I also heard you mention was that in many cases, these networks are not exclusive of each other, that there's a lot of overlap amongst these various networks, and they sort of build on a symbiotic relationship amongst them.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. So we, you know, in the book, we focus on race and gender justice, and we do have examples where it's one or the other, but almost all of them involve both race and gender justice, because of course those things are intertwined. And I'll add, you know, in this sort of COVID pandemic era, environmental and health justice are also intertwined with all of those things. So we see the kind of multiplicity of oppression and marginalization coming to bear and really being discussed in these networks and grappled with in real ways.
And another major contribution that you've made to web science is co-editing a volume called the Oxford Handbook of Networked Communication. Along with your own work in that area, you've talked a lot about the transformative power of networked counterpublics. How does the term networked counterpublics relate to hashtag activism?
Yeah, so this is, you know, thanks in huge part to my co-author, Sarah Jackson. We coined this term together, but it's an extension of public sphere theory. So very briefly, publics are groups of people who engage in democratic deliberation. And certain folks historically and presently are excluded from those kinds of deliberations. And so people of color, LGBTQ folks, women, and so on, aren't full participants, aren't always full participants. So they form counterpublics. And, you know, fast forward to the networked and online era, of course, these things are playing out online as well. So network counterpublics really captures this idea that there are groups of marginalized folks who are coming together online to discuss issues and then also advance counter narratives into the mainstream. So it's kind of a heady theoretical term, but it also has these really applied consequences or implications that we can see it happening in these coalitions of folks on the internet, bridging across web pages, blogs, different social media platforms, and so on, to really create and advance an agenda for social change.
This might sound as though the web is just absolutely superb and fantastic and utopian for celebrating network counterpublics, for hashtag activism, et cetera. And yet there are stories on the web where, for example, in the gaming community, there was a lot of attacks against female members of the community, et cetera. Can you talk about how the web might be having a dual-edged effect, both positive and negative, in the context of some of these issues?
Yeah, of course, that's right. The very same systems that enable progressive racial and gender justice activism, among other things, also enable regressive radicalization and harassment. But I'll also note that although I think the architecture of the web is set up to be open and available for everyone, the kind of corporatization and the capitalization of the web has created structures that are actually hard for marginalized folks to engage in. So the fact that we have Black Lives Matter or Me Too is not entirely because of the web, but sort of in spite of some of these corporate structures in place. So one of the things I think web science in general, and you know, in society in general, frankly, really needs to grapple with right now is what does a free and open web actually look like, and how might a web serve the cause of justice more than, you know, the flow of information sort of unfettered in ways that can be harmful. You know, there are no right answers to that, but I'm confident the web science community can figure it out.
So are you suggesting that we need to have a hashtag activism that focuses on the design of the web and to open the web? Hashtag open the web?
I love that idea. Sign me up.
Great. Well, I think there are many who would agree with you on that. So based on your perspectives and all the scholarship and activism and practitioner work that you have focused on in your own research and scholarship, what do you consider as some of the most significant issues that need to be further addressed by web science?
For sure, hashtag open the web is one of them. So how can we think about not just ethics in web science, but justice in web science, and how might we optimize a web for justice in order to correct current and historical harms. You know, I would also love to see a tighter integration of, you know, not just the social sciences and engineering and you know, STEM sciences, which I think web science does really well, but bridging into the arts and humanities as well. And so I think there's space to come up with interesting collaborations and interesting futures for the web when we bring in kind of the full spectrum of folks working on these spaces.
I think that's a very inspiring idea. Can you, just off the top, not to put you on the spot, mm-hmm. can you think of a couple of strategies that you would offer if open the web, hashtag open the web, became a thing and someone approached you and said, what's one thing we can do to start in that direction? What would you come up with?
That's a great question. So immediately one thing that comes to mind is creating activist-centered tools. So activists are now working within the sets of tools that are provided by corporations, which, you know, comes with things like surveillance of their data, corporate control over what they can and can't say. So more open access tools, things that folks can use on their own terms, where they can retract their data if they so choose, or maybe the end-to-end encryption in such a way that they can't be surveilled, comes to mind easily. You know, I would also love to see, obviously, more Black, Indigenous, and minority ownership over some of these systems. So promoting not only the, you know, kind of educational pipelines, which I think we're increasingly sensitive to, but also the corporate pipeline. So how do we get folks who are not just developers, but CEOs of companies and organizations working in this space, and obviously then collaborating with folks like that to make sure that their businesses are sustainable, you know, well-researched and accessible to everyone.
That sounds really exciting. You mentioned that one of the things that web science does well is cultivate collaborations between the social sciences with STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and you also advocated for bringing in more of the arts and the humanities. Can you give an example of a web science project? Can you point to one that has done that well, or a hypothetical project that could do that really well?
There's a book called Data Feminism, which is just a lovely example of how embracing the arts, humanities, social sciences, and technical sciences yields new insights on how to observe and subvert power on the web. So I totally recommend folks read it. They did a lovely job of just integrating across all of these things, showing how, you know, systems can oppress people, but also how people kind of subvert those oppressions through clever hacks and understanding both the art and the science of the web.
And so in what way did the arts and humanities contribute to this effort?
So in some ways, by studying sort of arts and artists collectives, gives inspirational ideas about how to think differently about power and organizational structure, right? So folks often have very different ways of organizing over there. So that's one concrete example. I think other ways, you know, sort of applying web science tools in order to create things that don't have, you know, sort of capitalist monetary value, if that makes sense. So things that are lovely to engage with or beautiful, but aren't necessarily efficient or profitable, I think helps scientists think differently about the value of their work. So engaging these exercises as a student or a practitioner might inspire new ways of thinking about what it is that we're doing here.
That's really good. Well, in closing here, I wanted to ask you a question that is relevant to our current times. And so what is the one or two most significant things, in your opinion, that would have been significantly different or for better or worse during the COVID-19 crisis and then the other crises that have now come along with that? To what extent would this have been different without the web? Can you conceive of what today would have been without the web?
So I'm going to give this response from my own sort of unique perspective as an American living in Massachusetts, raising kids. At a federal level, we had a pretty complete failure of communication, right? So that's an interesting example of when centralized communication really broke down in terms of what to do and how to do it. But we saw lots of people rising up on the web and taking that spot, disseminating good information, science-backed information on how to handle ourselves during a pandemic here in the US. So my friends who are epidemiologists suddenly got zillions of followers on Twitter, you know, because folks were looking to scientists directly, which I don't think would be possible without a social media, right, or a web. The other thing I want to lift up is just the incredible work of teachers and educational technology makers to create opportunities for children to stay connected and to stay learning. You know, as a parent of kids in that age category, it's been incredibly helpful, not only, you know, for their benefit, but for my benefit as someone who then needs to work and find a way to educate children and work at the same time. So, you know, the fact that those tools exist and that they can be disseminated locally, you know, regionally, and even globally, and kids can continue to have learning experiences, engage with one another and with educators all over the world, is pretty incredible. So I'm grateful for that.
And I'm glad that you prefaced it by saying that you were making these observations as an American based in Boston, because we know that these kinds of privileges that we might have here are not necessarily universal, and that while the web is the World Wide Web, the benefits of the web are not necessarily worldwide. And so your points are really well taken out there. I want to again thank you so much for talking with us about the work you do. You are uniquely positioned as one of the rising stars in the area of web science, both in terms of the research you do, in terms of the activism that you do, translating it into applied areas, working across a variety of disciplines. And I also want to take a minute to thank you for helping build a community of web science. You have been one of the organizers of web science conferences in previous years, and you've been a very active and engaged member of that community. So thank you again very much, Brooke, for taking time to talk with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Untangling the Web is a production of the Web Science Trust. This episode was edited by Molly Lubers. I am Noshir Contractor. You can find out more about our conversation today in the show notes. Thanks for listening.